You're listening to a Rhino.com podcast. Yes, you are.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Rhino podcast. Our streak remains unbroken as we yet again have another great show in store for you. Starting off is the one and only Bob Lefsetz, ruminating on the work of Pete Townsend. And following that, director Jason Reitman, actress Ellen Page, and singer-songwriter Kimya Dawson discuss music from the excellent film Juno. Buckle up and enjoy the show, my friends.
Every year is the same, I feel it again. I'm a loser, no chance to win. Leaves start falling, come down is calling. Loneliness starts sinking in, but I'm one. I am one, and I can see that this is me. I will be, you'll all see, I'm the one.
Hey, it's Bob Lefsetz here on the Rhinocast now monthly. That's Pete Townsend. I'm one. Actually, just entering the building here at Rhino in Burbank, I almost changed this to the very first hit from AC/DC. It's a long way to the top if you want to rock and roll. It's so hard to make it. And this song is about that, being how hard it is to make it. You may not be familiar with this version from Deep End Live, released in 1986, but you probably know the song from Quadrophenia. Is Quadrophenia the best Who album? You'd be surprised how many people believe that. I'm not one of them, although, you know, it's funny how people come up with certain things. I remember being in college, someone saying, name a better movie than Midnight Cowboy, okay? And we would have a hard time, okay? This was actually before The Godfather. I think Godfather 2 is the best movie ever made. You can email me and debate whether you agree or not. But people have said, name a better album than Who's Next. And I don't believe you can name a better album than Who's Next. And I've always been partial to Tommy. I mean, I certainly knew the Who were. I heard I Can See for Miles on the jukebox at Bromley in Vermont, and I bought the single. I think the flip side was Mary Ann with the Shaky Hands. And but Tommy, when I remember Pinball Wizard? Because he would start with that acoustic guitar and then wah! In the other ear. That was great. Tommy, I love that album. I went to see The Who at Fillmore East perform it. But it's a little dated now. For some reason on XM, they always play The Undertone. That would be the one track that I wouldn't really play. But so many great tracks. Christmas being that. Live at Leeds, you know, they're all the expanded versions. I got a problem with Live at Leeds because there's no crowd noise. I believe a live album should have crowd noise. It's one of the great reasons Frampton Comes Alive works. And don't give too much shit to Frampton, because prior to that point, he was a credible artist. It's only after that that his manager, D'Anthony, did I'm in You and killed his career, so now he's in commercials on television. But ultimately, in 1973, The Who put out another concept album called Quadrophenia. And it was not a raging success. I remember buying it just when it came out. I went to Corvettes. Corvettes, in case you don't know, was a big discount chain. It was somewhere between Walmart and Kmart. Because it was more upscale than that, but I don't want to say it was too upscale. And we bought our records there. Unlike Tops, the other place, they didn't staple the tag through the records. And I went there. I grew up in Fairfield, Connecticut. I went to Trumbull, Connecticut, where there's still a shopping park. It was called Trumbull Shopping Park. But the Corvettes is gone. Most people believe that EJ Corvette stands for 11 Jewish Korean War Veterans. We can have an email battle about that, but let's just assume it's true. And I was going to college in Vermont, and I would come to Connecticut for vacation, and I would buy, you know, six or seven records. And then I went to the theater in New Haven. Which is about 20 minutes from Fairfield, 15 minutes from Trumbull, to see Billy Jack, because this was when the phenomenon began. The movie had been made earlier, but now there was a buzz about it. And I remember buying the crap stuff at the concession stand. Remember those old ice cream cones? It was kind of like being able to get a real ice cream cone, but it had been frozen years before. And although they had paper on the top, and the top of the ice cream was flat to the cone itself had a weird consistency like paper itself, if you've ever eaten paper. And we've all eaten paper, even if we only did it in first grade. But I remember I had this bag of records, and EJ Corvette had a logo on the bag, but I cannot remember. Unlike the place I used to buy records of Vermont, which was just a plain bag. And I remember keeping the records vertical, upright, and if I'd slowed down, holding my arm to make sure that the records didn't move, because the records were that meaningful to me. And when I got home, I opened the package because it was so thick, and it was that huge booklet. And when I got back to college, I played the record. The opening track has a C sound, which I'm convinced he did on a synthesizer. And I played the album, and I liked it. And I played it a certain amount, et cetera. But there was kind of a bad vibe about the whole project. The Who ultimately went on the road, and Pete Townsend explained the story and kind of pissed people off. And it seemed like kind of a forgotten record. And then, of course, The Who became somewhat forgotten. You know, Keith Moon died, and it really wasn't the same. Then they had this movie, Quadrophenia. Frank Rodham, I believe. I believe that's the best rock movie ever made. You can debate. I just saw the U2 in 3D. That's great, but that's a concert film. This is a story. This puts Tommy to shame. I'm a Ken Russell fan. I used to see him at my favorite record store in Westwood, shopping all the time. But love Quadrophenia. But simultaneous with Quadrophenia, they put out a double live album soundtrack, which was remixed by John Entwistle, if I remember correctly. And the bass was much more prominent. And the bass work on Quadrophenia is unbelievable. But the record came alive. I always liked the song Sea and Sand. You know, the girl I love is a perfect dresser. Wears every fashion to a T. But the without getting too much into the story of the mods and the rockers and Brighton and the, you know, the pier and all the stuff, and the movie was great, there's the point of being the underdog, but believing you're somebody. And that's embedded in the record, but I didn't fully understand until I listened to the live take of I'm One on Deep End Live, released, as I say, 13 years later in 1986.
Where do you get those blue, blue jeans? Faded, that secret so tight. Where do you get that walk oh so lean? Your shoes and your shirt's always right, but I'm one. I'm one. And I can't see that this is me. I won't be. You'll all see I'm the one.
Okay. So this is a live record, basically at this point, just Pete Townsend and his acoustic guitar. But it's not like Scoop. These are not demos. He actually played live. And there's a certain intimacy, completely changes the meaning of the song. Instead of all the production with Moon's drumming, and the original is great, this adds character. This is the guy himself singing, you know, every year is the same and I feel it again. I'm a loser. No chance to win. That's rock and roll. All those geeks staying at home, listening to Vampire Weekend, that's how they feel. They want to be important. They want to count. And especially if you go back 30 years, because that was before the internet, before geeks were popular, it's like, you know, I listened to this record in the 90s when I was totally lost. That's how I felt. It's like, you know, I have feeling I'm a worthwhile person, but I can't get any traction. Leaves start falling, Come Down is calling, loneliness starts sinking in. Loneliness, the scourge of being an American. I can't really speak for other cultures, although in certain cultures there's a strong, you know, family element, which is kind of evaporated in America, certainly to a certain degree. And you feel lonely. What do you expect? That's why people commit suicide, because you're only forgetting the people who are bipolar and literally sick. I feel sorry for those people. But a lot of people, you know, they have this defeat. They have the sense of being a loser, and they're lonely, and they kill themselves. And the chorus, but I'm one, and I can see that this is me, and I will be you all. See, I'm the one. All these people who make it in Hollywood, they start off in their little town, forgetting the people who are scions of famous people to begin with, and they have to believe. Belief is at least 50%, or to flip the story over, talent is at most 50%. You have to believe in yourself. I'm one, and that's what he's saying. He's a loser, but he's going to make it. And we just heard the verse, where do you get those blue, blue jeans, faded patch secret so tight? Where do you get that walk-o-so lean, your shoes and your shirt all just right, but I'm one? you know, I remember seventh grade, you know, that's when they mixed all the people together. Now it's totally different because you have middle school from fifth to eighth. I don't know how they get the people in that same, you know, 4 year. Because like maybe in sixth grade, you start to feel your sexuality. But what about the people in fifth grade in school with people from eighth grade? That doesn't make any sense. But where I went to school, it was K through six, and seventh and eighth were junior high. And they mixed everybody from my side of town into this one school. And you want to stand out. You want the girls to notice you. And everybody's just so much cooler than you are.
I got a Gibson without a case, but I can't get that even tan look on my face. Ill-fitting clothes, and I blend in the crowd. Fingers so clumsy, voice too loud, but I'm one. And I can see that this is me, and I will be. You are seeing.
You know, I couldn't cut it off before the final chorus. I got so into it because the song is so intimate and so alone. And then the exuberance at the end. I'll show you. I'm the one. I got my gumption up. We have the verse. I got a Gibson without a case. Can't even afford the fucking case. But the interesting thing is on Pete Townsend's first solo album, Who Came First, he has a song called Sheraton Gibson, sitting in the Sheraton Gibson with my Gibson. Interesting connection written around the same time. But I can't get that even tan look on my face. Whatever I do. And look at Pete Townsend. Does he look like a rock star? Tall, geeky, big nose, ill-fitting clothes. I blend in the crowd, fingers so clumsy, voice too loud. Forgetting, you know, today, auto-tune and all this perfection. When you start, you kind of suck. And people throw shit at you, or worse, don't even pay attention to you. But you have this strong desire. In this case of these musicians in the 60s, you know, what came first, the talent or the desire? I don't know. But they needed to make it. They needed to get out of the environment they were in. And this song encapsulates it. That was encapsulates in case I put a few too many syllables in there, syllables as the case may be. And you hear this version and it comes alive. And all of a sudden, the song came alive, took me back to Quadrophenia, and made me realize how fucking great it was. Buy this track, if nothing else. On Deep End Live, there's also a cover. Save it for later. You'll be interested in. But you need to own this track. Till next time, it's Bob Lefsetz for the RhinoCast.
If I was a flower growing wild and free, all I'd want is you to be my sweet honeybee. And if I was a tree growing tall and green, all I'd want is you to shade me and be my leaves.
All I Want Is You is a perfect example of what can be found if you are willing to iTunes surf for hours on end. I had been searching all sorts of words and names and going deeper and deeper into the library until I found this song that just caught me. I had never heard it. I didn't know who Barry Lewis Pulisar was. I came to discover that he was this 70 children's folk singer. And this song just touched me. There was something lovely about it. I didn't know it at the time, but I came to find out that he recorded it, hymned in a guitar in the basement of his home. And there was something about the handmade quality that was the perfect introduction to this film. And I immediately sent it over to my opening title guys, and they began creating the opening title sequence to correspond to the music.
Cause he gets up in the morning, then he goes to work at night, and he comes back home with
the Kinks. Well-Respected Man has always been a favorite song of mine, and it's odd because there's another movie that I'm writing, and I've always associated it with the introduction of a character in this other movie. And when I made the decision to bring it into Juno, to actually bring it to the editing room and try it with Bleeker, it was a little heartbreaking for me because I had always really associated with this other film, and I knew by putting it into Juno, I would not be able to use it in this other film one day. But ultimately, the sacrifice had to be made, and it kind of seems perfect for Michael Cera.
Polaroid down in my room, I'm pretty sure you have a new girlfriend. It's not.
I get really emotionally attached to music, which I'm sure a lot of people do. Sometimes it feels irrational, and I use it a lot when I'm working, and so I know what it feels like, you know, to be passionate about something really, really specific, something that inexplicably moves you so much, And when you relate to other people with music, it's always an interesting way of relating it.
Do you want to tell a story, though? I'm always telling a story because it's always from my perspective. I'd love to hear kind of how you remember it.
Okay, yeah. All right. Well, it was probably the second or third time we were meeting, and I was in Jason's office, which has wonderful little, like, bunny ninjas everywhere, and it's a great office. You know what I mean?
I like the picture you're setting for people. All they know about the office is bunny ninjas.
I think people will be very excited about that, Jason. And Jason
Bunny
said to me, "Well, what do you think Juno would listen to?" And I replied, "Well, the Moldy Peaches." And he didn't know who the Moldy Peaches were, and I was surprised because he, you know,
seemed so cool.
Yeah, he seemed so cool.
I know. It was all a facade.
Yeah, it was all a facade. And so I went on his computer, and, you know, I closed the All Saints song, and I brought up the Moldy Peaches and played him, I believe it was Anyone Else But You, and he fell in love.
Mateo's a guy I've known for a long time, and I've always looked forward to the idea of collaborating with him, and this just seemed like the perfect opportunity. I showed him the Moldy Peaches music and Kimmy's music and said, "This is what I want to key into. This is the sound of the film, and I want you to find a way to make a musical score that has the same recording quality and the same kind of tone and feel. There's a kind of an innocence to their music that I thought was perfect for the film." And he, you know, started to bring over instrumentalists to try to record stuff, but often nothing would ever recreate it as much as Kimmy is playing herself. So Mateo and I went up to Seattle to record instrumental versions of Kimmy's song. Do you want to talk maybe a little about kind of the experience of how I asked you to do this?
I live in Olympia, Washington, and Jason was going to be in Seattle. And I was like, "I'll come to Seattle. We'll record some instrumentals." And so I went up to the studio. We recorded some instrumentals, which is totally absurd to me because, like, in my mind, because I can barely play guitar, my music is all about the words. And so I was like, "Instrumentals, huh? Boring. But it sounds nice. It's okay. It works."
And then we did some versions where you hummed over them, too.
Oh, right. I was humming for, like, 3 hours. We had to be like, do we do, like, do-do-do's or, like, boo-boo-boos or la-la-las or ha-ha-has.
My favorite
so I did
was
like
the,
20 versions.
My favorite was the guzz.
Oh, yeah. Go, 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 go.
Like no song should ever be hummed.
Oh, my God.
When I found out Anyone Else But You was going to be at the end and Michael and I were going to get to play it, that was incredible, because it's a song that's been in my life for, like, a while, years. You know, I always put it on those mix CDs where you're like, "Hey, want to fall in love with me?" You know? You know, your crush mixes, those embarrassing things.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's Moldy Peaches song. It's not my song. But if you go on YouTube and type in the Moldy Peaches, there's more videos of kids covering our songs than of us playing our songs. Like, I don't know what it is. Like, kids love to, like, play those songs.
You're a part-time lover and a full-time friend. The monkey on your back is the latest trend. Don't see what anyone can see in anyone else.
But like, I got to watch them filming that scene, and I was totally freaking out. And then I, like, it was eavesdropping on them practicing in the other room, and Ellen was like, "I feel Kimmy is here," and I was like, "I feel weird, this is crazy." And so everybody was a little like, like really excited about it. But I felt like they were the perfect people to play a Moldy Peaches song. Me and Adam were just, you know, kids. Like when we wrote the song, just kind of like awkward kids, like wanting to make people fall in love with us.
I'm in love with how you feel. I don't see what anyone can see.
The script, Juno, was musical in itself, in that you had characters who played music together and almost defined their relationship in the way that they played music together. And in addition to that, there were songs that were written directly into the script. One obvious case was Superstar.
You told me you loved me, baby. You said you'd be coming back.
Which was interesting in that it was a song from Mark's era being covered by a group from Juno's era, and yet Mark's character liked the band that was new, and Juno's character would have liked the band that was older. I think it's that kind of wonderful irony in the music that helped define their relationship. I wouldn't have known Cat Power if it weren't for the young lady sitting to my left.
I love Chan Marshall. I love all of her music. And that covers album where Sea of Love is obviously from is just ridiculous. A lot of her music paralyzes me. I find it so beautiful. And I've listened to it so much while I've worked, actually. She's just one of those staples in my life. And that song is so, one of those songs that's so simplistic and so minimal and just absolutely stunning and works perfectly. And I remember when you had it in, you know, kind of as temp at first, because mm-hmm. you never know if you're going to get a song. And I was bugging him so much. Like, did we get the song? Did we get the song? Like,
well, also cinematically, Sea of Love also already kind of has its place in cinema history, so I was a little trepidatious about putting it into our movie because there's kind of already this film reference. But Cat Power brought such a new take to that song that I felt we could almost kind of reinvent what it meant in a movie. And the scene is so beautiful. And I, to be perfectly honest, I thought what Ellen and Michael did as actors in that scene was so stunning that I couldn't quite find another song that lived up to them, and it seemed like perfect harmony.
You've just listened to a Rhino.com podcast. Visit Rhino.com for music, movies, and all kinds of crazy shit.